We've been asked to discuss a very important problem for young girls. So if any non-young girls would like to leave, they can do now. Are there any non-young girls about? No. The problem has been put, what can a girl do, considering the condition of young men today, to get in touch with her own masculine half, instead of looking for their masculine half? Any comments on the nature of the problem first? Are you over 21 there? Joking about, you know, that women are ageless, are they not? So the question of the advance of time in relation to women is irrelevant. Every little girl is born millions of years old, and every old lady is a girl at heart. This is a very serious problem, so we have to consider it seriously. At the top here, we have a circle, and this circle represents the original egg of the human being. We know there was an original egg because we all derived from parents. And at some remote time in the past, there must have been a mutation, a change in the germplasm, which turned a creature that was not yet human into a human being. We know that we start life with a very simple primordial soup. That is to say, the oceans are full of chemistry, primitively in a certain delicate state of balance, requiring only a flash of lightning to turn them into the first stage of living substance. We have to think about this ocean of life as what we call a protopathic sensorium. Protopathic means the first kind of sensitive suffering. It's a kind of indiscriminate way of receiving reality that you see in a newborn baby. A newborn baby does not yet separate itself from the environment. It hasn't had sufficiently intense different stimuli to make it different intentions in the body from the environment. Its body feeling has not yet been stimulated sufficiently through the senses, particularly through sight and hearing, for the child to differentiate between itself and the environment. Those of you with good memories will remember that when you were very little children, you were quite unaware of the differentiating lines between things and between you and the external world, you and external feelings, you and other people's emotions. You know that if a mother cries, often a baby cries because the mother is crying. Not because it's seen the mother cry, but because it feels the emotion of the mother. This is what we mean by protopathic experience. It is an experience in which discrimination of oneself and the other has not yet been made. Now, imagine a primordial soup, that is to say, the same kind of chemistry that we could get out of a single cell in our body, but imagine the same chemistry spread through the oceans of the world, rather thinly, but still there. And it is sentient. It feels. It is not yet egotistic, but it does feel. It hasn't got a specific reference center. It hasn't got a particularized idea yet, but it has got sensitivity. And this is a very interesting thing. Imagine this ocean. I mean that literally. An ocean of chemistry in water And the chemist is so delicately balanced that it is sensitive. It becomes colloidal. It begins to draw upon itself and the stimuli. When the stimuli hit it, they produce a reaction, and the stimulus can be either just right, that means say the energy input can be assimilated fairly easily, or it could be insufficient. That is to say, the energy input will be so small that the receiving colloid, the receiving protoplasm, could easily take in more and therefore begin to draw upon it. Or the stimulus could be excessive. That is to say, the energy input could be so great that it begins to disturb and even disrupt, break the protoplasmic unity and introduce a very primitive form of death by disintegration. Now, if we imagine that under repeated stimuli of the right order, certain zones of this primordial soup, this protoplasmic colloidal soup, begin to cohere and they begin to make primordial bodies, protoplasmic beings, very vague, very indeterminate at their edges, but still, nevertheless, they are beings. They are locatable in space. They do receive stimuli from outside themselves, and under the stimulus, they either draw themselves together, try to draw more in, or try to tense themselves to defend themselves against an excessive energy input. But in the process of this repeated stimulation, they gradually become more and more determinate. Their edges become more and more clear, until we finally arrive at a condition that we would recognize when we see either an amoeba or a simple monocellular life, a life form of only one cell. Now this is what this circle represents. Now you can see that if we have a mass of this colloidal, chemically balanced protoplasm, and the mass is very big, then the assimilation process of intaking of stimulus energy must be relatively very slow. So that if we are going to move towards integration and towards greater self-consciousness and greater control, then we could save a few million years if we were to accelerate the process of evolution. Now, this acceleration requires that we reduce the size of the mass. Now, we could do this by simply cutting away progressively portions of the mass from the outside, or we can do another trick. We can subdivide this mass, process of mitosis. We can cut this mass into millions and millions of little pieces, all chemically more or less identical, all sentient, but now, because of their smaller mass, less inert, more mobile. Now, if we apply this to a simple monocell, like the egg in a woman, we find that an egg, which is, say, roughly 1,000 times bigger than a sperm from a male, that egg is relatively immobile. It doesn't have legs, it doesn't have a tail, it doesn't rush about. When it comes down the fallopian tube, it is shuffled along that tube by little hair-like processes. It doesn't have its own power of motility. Consequently, its movements are relatively very slow, and its change from one environment to another is also slow, in consequence of which the differential stimuli, the different kinds of experiences that it has, must also be encountered in a relatively slow way. Now, by a simple process of compression, of further reduction of the protoplasmic cell, and a protruding from that cell of a portion of it, and a specialization of it into a tail, we turn a primary monocell into a sperm. This sperm has its own motor. If you put a sperm under a microscope, you can see, and with the electron microscope today, you can see very well the subdivisions along the tail. Think about the head of a sperm is just like the ovum that a woman carries, but the tail of that sperm is the same kind of protoplasm, but specially organized to propel itself along at a very fast rate considering its small size. In other words, the sperm shows you a way of traveling through an environment more and more quickly, and thus gaining more and more experience in less and less time. Now, this is the origin of the differentiation into what we know as male and female. And the characteristics, physically and psychologically, are in correspondence. That is to say that the ovum of the woman is relatively less mobile, is more dependent on external stimulus to move it along, whereas the sperm of a man is self-mobilizing, has a principle inside it of utilizing energy to thrash its tail and drive itself along. Now, in the same way, the female tends to the type of the ovum. That is to say, she tends to be relatively immobile unless stimulated from outside. And the male, the sperm mentality, tends to be driving and push itself about and pursue external experiences in a way that the ovum of the woman does not. So we could say, these being correspondent, the analogue is quite practically good enough. The woman specializes in physicality and immobility and sensitivity. She feels that she's relatively immobile. If she does not get the external stimulus, she would tend to be still, and she would tend to feel. We have mentioned before that in the butterfly catching industry in South America, you get one female butterfly hanging in a tree in a cage, and from all directions of the compass come male butterflies. Now, it cannot be that she's sending out a perfume, because that would depend on the wind to carry it away, and the male butterflies would come in a direction determined by the wind, but they come from all directions. This means that the female is somehow sending out a message to the males, come here. She is the center of a radiating sensorium. This means to say that the males are tuned, without their being aware of it, to respond to the call from the female element. Let's think about this very carefully, because it's absolutely basic. The woman is apparently still, apparently immobile physically, but she is permeated by and surrounded by an extended biomagnetic field, and she is continuously pulling into the center of her being with a special message. I am here, I am female, come and get me. And this goes out from her being. And at a very, very subtle level, the sperm can feel that there is a direction in which he must move. Something in him drives him, the energy in the tail part of his being. Something in him receives a direction. So he rushes about, at first haphazardly, and then out of his movements the sensitivity comes, we go this way. So the sperm can find its way over what for it is a very long distance, in a very difficult situation, and it can swim into the uterus and up the fallopian tube and meet an egg. There is a peculiarly subtle interrelation between these two. Now, if we remember what we said, if this cell eats and gets bigger, the bigger it gets, the less quick it will be able to move. It will move less and less quickly the bigger it gets. And therefore, from the point of view of survival probabilities, it would be better for it to limit its size so that it doesn't become so immobile that it cannot escape an enemy or cannot acquire information quickly enough. So a division of labor occurs. The egg, the primordial mass, what is called in certain oriental philosophies the cosmic egg, the energy field that comes from the sun, what in Indian philosophy is called Surya Prana, the prana, the energy from the sun, that energy divides itself. Here in the diagram we put a simple straight line to divide it. That is for our convenience. And then it separates itself out, and one half goes into one environment and the other goes into another. Imagine in the water such a piece of protoplasm having an experience of its environment, then divides itself and then swims away east and west. Supposing one half goes into deeper water, one half into shallower water, then the one that goes into deep water, if it goes down, will receive less stimulation from the sun's energy than the one that goes into the shallower water, and so there will be an energy differentiation in the two. The one that gets the greatest stimulation will begin to show the greatest type of reactivity, and the one that gets less stimulation will be relatively slower. So we find in the oceans a kind of life, apart from a few predators like very fast sharks and so on, we find a peculiar type of life, a jellyfish, which is carried largely by the tides of the sea, but when it does move, it moves in a very gentle, undulating way, very reminiscent of the way females walk and move. And this jellyfish kind of life is a sort of tide life for the ocean. It is an undulating life. It is a cyclically phasic life. It is a life very, very sensitive to ocean currents. It is very sensitive to moon phases. And it is aware of the environment around it and the pressures of tides, the differences of temperature, more than a quick-moving predator, also in the sea, like a shark. Now we know that in the evolutionary sense, the animals that first appeared on the land had climbed out of the sea. There must have been ones near the edge of the sea, and as they climbed out, they turned, like certain mud skippers do even today, they turned their fins into legs. There are fish the other side of the equator that can climb trees. You may know some of the fish after the Pacific atomic bomb experiment. Some of the fish came out of the sea and started walking about on their fins. Some kind of mutation was occurring, something similar to the one that occurred millions of years ago. But those that developed legs are beginning to become more directionally conscious. Now, separate them out in this way, and then we'll put a differentiator on it to remind us. We call this the dexter side in heraldry, the right-hand side. Imagine this is a shield facing you, carried by the enemy. That's where he puts his lance, that's his right side, and that's his left. Now, in heraldry, the right side is called dexter. That means done externally. And the left side is called sinister. That means hidden, secret. The dexter side is the side that grows the tail, and the other side will round itself off and become an egg. But because when we divided these two, we pushed the two halves apart, we left a biomagnetic charge. It's even measurable electronically today in terms of microvolts, We need a charge that means that they're continuously being reminded biomagnetically that really they are the same being split. Now this is the basis of all human ethics, and it's the basis of sexual relationship. The original protoplasm, having divided, went off in two different directions, and one side of it tended to develop more motility than the other, and that particular side eventually finished up with a tail, and we call those boys and the other ones girls. Now there's a great advantage to this, as we shall see later, but there is a terrible disadvantage until you understand it. The two halves here, when they've been away in a different environment for a long time, they have a different internal content, don't they? One knows about shallow waters, one knows about deep waters. The more they differentiate in this way, the less vocabulary they have in common. And this is represented in early Renaissance and medieval manuscripts by turning the circle round and putting the two halves back to back and then tying them together. The tension between them guarantees that they're interested in each other, but the difference of their environmental stimulus records guarantees that they can't understand each other. Now this itself is a bad, good thing. It's bad because the two partners to the alliance have dissimilar vocabularies, dissimilar ideas, and find it extremely difficult to understand each other. But that very, very same thing, which if they could understand each other, would not exist, because if they could understand each other, they'd be happy, and they'd be adjustable, and they would do that terrible thing, falling into comfort mechanisms. If they really got on as well with each other as they would like to do, they would fall asleep in each other's arms. You know what young lovers are like? They like to be in each other's arms, and they like to think nobody else exists, and they like to think they're in a kind of private Eden, and they'd like to stay there forever and ever, amen. But if they did what they want to do, they could not evolve. So mysteriously, the differential stimuli that have made these beings, warning, are very useful for furthering evolution, for accelerating the rate of development of us. Because every time we have a misunderstanding, we stimulate each other more and more and more in an annoying way. And this kind of stimulation forces us to try to find new ways of adjusting ourselves to this double attack. Now, using the terminology of ancient Egypt, we could say, once upon a time, there was a period called the period of Isis. Isis is a moon goddess, and the old anthropologists would have said, studying that period, it was a period of matriarchy. It was the period when men did not know that they fathered children, because it's, say, 10 lunar months from intercourse to the production of a child. And it's a long time to remember where you were. So there seemed to be hardly any connection between the increasing girth of this lady and something that happened in a semi-drunk stupor 10 lunar months ago. So the gentleman responsible and liable to be called to account, saw no connection between it. And for thousands and thousands of years, men did not know that they were the fathers of children. And during this period, they worshipped the woman as a kind of magical creature, a goddess, omniscient, omnipotent, because she, the great mother, Mahama, the great Ma of the universe, she knew everything about everybody. And she had a deep intuition that somehow what happened to her to produce the child had got something to do with the men. Even today, sensitive women know when they have conceived. At proletarian level, they call it clicked. I don't know if you've ever had that expression. Ooh, I clicked. How awful. What will I do now? They become aware of a peculiar kind of change in biotension inside themselves that now spells pregnancy. And when they get it, they know they've got it. But the men don't know they've got it until the girls tell them. Now, for thousands of years, women with this secret information dominated the human race. The great-grandmother dominated all her daughters and sons, and all her granddaughters and grandsons, so the three generations constituted a tribe. Tri, three, the house. In one great house called the Long House, there were three generations, and that was enough to constitute a tribe. Because this magical woman could have lots and lots of husbands because they saw no connection, and she could have children, and as soon as the children were born and became themselves nubile, they could start on the same process, and then her grandchildren. Soon there'd be quite a lot of these, and she, the grandmother of all these, could order them about because she was the source of their being. She was the great goddess. She was Ishtar. She was Ashtaroth. She was Isis. She was the great moon goddess. So the anthropologists will tell you about these matriarchal lunar cultures. They're lunar cultures because the women know that something to do with this pregnancy thing is menstruation, and this has something to do with the moon. So we call them the great matriarchal lunar cultures. And this went on for a long time, and we find plenty of evidence, not only in the peat bogs of Denmark, where men have pegged out and left there to die, having been previously carefully drugged so they won't fight too much, because you know that ladies are very good at making Irish stews that are lethal. And on one special historic occasion, a mutant arose. A man suddenly got an idea. His mind suddenly made a connection. The connection was quite simple. He observed that the women who were capable of becoming pregnant weren't too bad looking. And some that were absolutely horrible to look at hadn't got this magical power. So he began to think, why do the horrids not beget these magical children? And he began to think, and he discovered the horrids don't have visitors. Call men. And then click, like one of Curlew's chimpanzees. Ah, insight. It's something to do with us. So he thought, well, we'll try it. And Socrates gives evidence of this, because he says a man who has intercourse only with beautiful ladies isn't really testing himself. So how about getting a horrid that hasn't managed to do this magical trick and doing a little bit of early empirical experiment with her? It's not difficult to get her to join in the experiment, so why not try? And behold, result, the horrids deliver a child. Only half horrid. She's... These half horrids, incidentally, in the Bible are called Nephilim. Titans. Winston Churchill was one. Roosevelt was another. Stalin was another. Mussolini was another. Half-horrids. I'm not joking, you know. Now, once the secret was out, did the man that discovered it tell everybody? Give me an offer. Did he tell everybody? Why not? Power trick. If he told all the men, they'd all start wanting to be free, wouldn't they? They might all start being generous to the horrids. What they would become aware of was that they need not obey women as goddesses anymore. So, he had a problem. He discovered it. He couldn't work the thing single-handed. So he invented Freemasonry, old style. That is to say, he told his closest friend about this and said, try it out and see if it isn't true, and then we'll make a brotherhood of knowledgeable men who know the rule, and we will make a band of such men, and then we will rise up and we will overthrow the matriarchs. And they got together and they made a club, First Gentlemen's Club, means where the gentlemen club together, and we have the rape of the Sabine women and the overthrow of the Amazon women as historical examples of this process. Suddenly, the men with the insight get together, they smash the matriarchal authority. Once they have done so, they begin to go about in that reactive manner that the newly free always do. They went about, they smashed every evidence they could find of matriarchal dominion, and they established a new thing called the Age of Osiris, the sun god, the patriarch. Daddy is now in charge. But not all men were told this truth. Most of them, 95% of them, were left with the illusion that mother still ruled. This is what we call Mariolatry, the worship of the Mary principle, or mother principle, is for the generality of men who are not to be told that men really can be fathers, really have initiative, really can show more mobility and a greater capacity to evolve at faster rates than women do. Now, once again, it had to be a secret to begin with, and that was a good thing, because it meant that only the best men were let into the secret. But like all secret organizations, it had a drawback, because it produced an oligarchy of men who very jealously guarded their secrets and would not let them out, even to men that could have understood them. And so there appeared a great social division between a handful of men that knew the rules and a great mass of men who did not. Now, the battle raged between the women and the men. We'd had a division of labor. The men went out and they gathered food, or they hunted, and the women stayed at home, and when the food was brought back, they cooked it, they divided it, and this is the origin of women stay at home, men go out. It is perfectly obvious that when the men were out hunting and shooting and fishing and things like that, they were being wildly excited in what was happening. Interesting things were happening. And when the women were at home, there was nothing much going on except a waiting process for the men to return. So that the domestic clothes situation was less stimulating than the external exposed hunting situation. So again, the men had been gaining, through plentiful stimuli, more and more opportunity for accelerated development, and the women were slowing down. But when the men finally overthrew the matriarchs and established the Age of Osiris, the sun-worshipping patriarchs, the women didn't take it completely lying down. Whatever weapons they had got, they used, and they hid back wherever they could. Now, because they were the keepers of the house and the preparers of the food, they became specialists in poisoning techniques, as the men had been specialists in violence techniques. And so, when the women did not particularly like the bad way they were being treated by the men, they retaliated by bad cooking, and sometimes by lethal cooking, as you know, right up into the Italian Renaissance, when this kind of poisoning technique was largely a woman's weapon. Now, this process was never exposed thoroughly to both men and women. And the battle raged between the lunar matriarchal cultures and the solar patriarchal cultures, and from side to side the stimuli swung, and they gradually produced another type, And this type we call the Age of Horus. Horus is a hawk-headed god, and he is the product. He is the son of Isis in the myth and of Osiris. He is the being who is being born today. This is very interesting, because through the clash of man-woman in the marital situation, the children are progressively becoming more and more hermaphroditic. That is to say, instead of a straight, clear division, as in the early days of the matriarchs, where the men went out and baby knew where daddy was, he'd gone hunting to get a rabbit skin to wrap the baby bunting in. And he knew where mother was, she was at home cooking it and saving the best bit for her lover. Now, gradually through the interchange of the intermarital fight, the children saw sometimes daddy one, sometimes mother one. But you could never tell which one was going to win the final battle. So, a new law began to operate, the Horus law. Now, Horus means, like the word horse means, hierarchy of powers. Hierarchy. The child began to see there was a hierarchy of power that swung from the dexter to the sinister side and back again to the dexter side, and it was continuously oscillating. So in progressive generations, this law operated. Now you know that if children see father and mother fighting, they always watch with wide eyes to see who wins. And if there's a clear victory for one or the other, the child copies the behavior of the victor. So in the old days, a boy with a hunting father who knew how to hit out, he would stand up and he would hit out too. But if the father wasn't there and he saw the mother giving orders, he'd wonder whether he ought not better be a mother. Transvestism today is just another echo of this kind of problem. But when the battle rages, the child copies both. This is very interesting. So that as we go forward in evolution, we show that we are more and more obviously hermaphroditic. That is to say, we have techniques of the man and the woman in both the boys and the girls. And it is this fact that led this young girl to say, can we please talk about the problem for a girl who today, when she goes to get a boy, often finds she's getting somebody as girlish as she is. How can she contact the man within? We know there's a man within because the original egg divided into male and female. So the original protoplasmic mass must have had the potentiality of maleness and femaleness. And that potentiality has been split. Different environments have been encountered, different experiences have been gained, and all those experiences are recorded in the human protoplasm. So today we are in the age of Horus. We are in the age of that combined being who has learned tricks from the mother and tricks from the father, and at this stage of evolution doesn't know whether to go on one side or the other, but hasn't clearly seen that he has to go on both sides and unify these two techniques of life and bring them back into the original state of unity, plus the value of the memory of the separated evolutionary steps through which it has gone. Now the question was, how does a girl get in touch with the man within her? The search for that has produced, as you know, a new type of being, a girl that begins to think that she might think. She's been provoked to it by a boy who is looking at his mother and father and using a bit of the techniques of both, so that he hasn't got the decisiveness of one of the Nietzschean supermen. You remember Nietzsche, in describing the Superman, the Germanic blonde beast, said, "Women are for the delectation of the warrior." That's only the 19th century. Women are for the delectation of the warrior. That means that they have really no other use than amusing men after the men have had a battle. That was an attempt to restate an ancient tradition. We can call it the Mithraic tradition if we like. The age of the militarist male who, by sheer physical force, by initiative, by deliberate violence, can conquer external beings and then appropriate them to his use. That blonde beast, as defined, if he really existed in his pure form, would smash all opposition with violence and would then divide the defeated into two categories: those he could use as slaves and those worthy of his sexual attention. Now we know that that was a kind of pipe dream, that the blonde beast in his pure form does not exist. We know that Hitler himself is not a blonde beast. We know that a lot of the Nazi parties did not have blue eyes and sunny golden hair. A lot of them had brown eyes and brown or black hair. They weren't pure enough to fulfill the definition. What we do know is that all people being born today and that have been born since the turn of this century are tending towards a hermaphroditic state. That is, they are tending to balance the male and female sides of their being, so that the males in them are there and the females in them. So if it's got the external form of a boy, more or less, it does not mean that it's an old Mithraic militarist man of initiative and violence. It could equally well be a very, very quiet, subtle weaver of patterns, of feelings and of ideas, a wheedler, as much as a man of violence. Simultaneously, because of this female emergent in the so-called male, the females have had to start thinking to themselves, can we find a masculine principle inside ourselves so that we can rescue ourselves from being toys for warriors, considering the warriors don't exist? Now, having set the general outline of this, we can now start to answer the question. The question is, how does a girl get in contact with the male side of her being? Let's assume for a moment that until we get the balance of male-femaleness properly inside ourselves as individuals, we will never attain ultimate happiness. Let's see why. Because we have a physical body, and we said that is a female stress, and we have a feeling kind of existence, and that is female, but we also have motility, mobility, and this mobility is masculine. Women are as mobile today as men are. They have a superior stress on their feeling and their preference for physicality, but in fact they can move. A woman on skis can give quite a good performance today. She's not just a piece of jelly sitting in the shack waiting for male gentlemen to come back off the ski run. She's able to join in, and she doesn't tumble much more than he does, except in the early stages, which is so she can be picked up by him. Now, how to become in contact with the masculine side of being? The female has to initiate activity inside herself, because initiative, The stouting of mobility is a masculine characteristic, and she has to do another thing. She has to commit herself to the logic of the situation. Now this is the hardest bit. The male mind has developed itself logically whilst the female was developing in feeling and emotion. So for a female to develop her masculine side, she has to develop submission to logic. Now tell me truthfully, ladies, do you like the idea of submitting your lives to the dictates of logic? Any offers? Logic. Let me tell you of two kinds of logic now. One we'll call Aristotelian logic. The Aristotelian logic is very rudimentary, it's very simple. It consists in saying that the letter A shall represent the letter A, and any other letter than the letter A shall not represent the letter A. We call that A equals A, and not A equals not A. And another law, a being must either be A or not A. It can't be in the middle. That's all it is. A thing is what it is. It is not what it is not. A machine being what it is and being what it is not, there is no middle. That's Aristotelian logic. That's very simple. Is there any problem about it? You are what you are not what you are not. A machine being what you are and not being what you are, there is no middle. Sounds easy, doesn't it? An orange is an orange, it's not a non-orange. A non-orange is not an orange. And between being an orange and a non-orange, there is no middle. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? It's simple, and it's useful in certain clearly defined situations to do with material objects that can be clearly defined and separated from each other. But it hasn't much use outside. Suppose we take an example. We take one apple. Verily it is an apple and not a not apple. And we start to peel it with our teeth. Is it still an apple when we take the first bit off? Is it a slightly peeled apple? So you go around it until you get all the peel off. Is it now a peeled apple? Then you start biting into it. First bite. Is it now an apple with one bite out? Or is it less an apple? And you go on biting bits out. At a certain critical point, you come to the old joke about, is it a half apple, not eaten, or is it a not half apple, that's the part that's been eaten? Or, is the pint of beer half drunk, half full, or half empty? In any dynamic situation, in any changing situation, that logic is too crude. So we have another kind of logic. And this kind of logic we call logo-logic. From logos, a Greek word meaning ratio, and it is the word that is used in the fourth gospel to signify the second person of the Trinity, the creator of the world. Logos, ratio. Logos, a word that means ratio. The ratio of realities. This Logos is the same concept that is applied to the person of Jesus Christ. He is the incarnate Logos. That simply means he is a man who has wholly given himself to operate the principle of the Logos. Now, we're going to draw the Logos so that we don't get mixed up. Sometimes a diagram saves a lot of trouble. Here is the Greek letter L. That's lambda. And here is the Greek letter gamma. I'll thicken the gamma one up to differentiate it. We've now written the word leg. Or log, or lig, in a primitive language like Hebrew or Arabic, There were no vowels, as it went, in the Egyptian. So we could say, we have written L, hard G, gamma, lambda, gamma. Now the lambda signifies light, signifies consciousness, and the gamma signifies physical body, inertia, unconsciousness. And now I'm going to make a very funny dialectical statement. Whatever we can assert of the one, we can assert of the other, only hidden. That is to say that the gamma is lambda inverted, and the lambda is gamma inverted. We'll find this to be a very important concept. Your consciousness is the sole means whereby you know that there is a world. The world is gamma, that is substantiality. Lambda is consciousness, but the only evidence that you have that there is a world, equals gamma, is your consciousness equals lambda. That is to say, the world that you know, and this includes your physical body, which is a gamma function, the world that you know is a phenomenon in and of consciousness. No lambda, that is consciousness, no gamma. But no gamma, that equals physical body, no content for lambda. If you haven't got a body, you haven't got a content for consciousness. Now, that is LG. We'll put an O in the middle and an O round it outside like that. We've now written logo, L-O-G-O. We lack only an S, which we'll put in a moment. The small circle on the inside we will let represent the O that follows the L, and the big one we will let represent the O that follows the hard G, the gamma. So we could read L-O, and we could read GO. Logo. A logo means a body permeated with consciousness. Golo means appetite, eating substance. When you talk about your gullet down here, and when you talk about the golo or colon, you're using the same word in a slightly modified way. The appetible nature that draws in energy in the form of food and deposits it in the physical body is the gamma principle. And the consciousness, the lambda, just observes that consciousness. Now let's for a moment allot these two to the male and female principles. And a very interesting piece of dialectic comes in. The gamma is occupied with physicality, so we would have to say it is feminine. The gamma principle is feminine. It's to do with the physical body and the sensation of physicality. But the lambda principle is to do with consciousness, and because consciousness is structured formally, it is to do with formal awareness, with intellect, is male. So we say the gamma is female, the lambda is male. And yet mysteriously, because women receive from men in the process of being impregnated, and they receive factors of heredity which they perpetuate through their children, and there are gifts in children because they receive, the children receive characteristics from the parents, so the abilities of the child are a product of the lambda-gamma relation of the parents. And as each child has two parents, it follows there must be a gamma aspect female in the child, that is its physicality, and there must be a lambda aspect in the child, the preoccupation with the increase of consciousness, which is male. So every child born is male-female. Now, you know this word,
eunuch.
I'll put a hyphen in there. There's a statement in the New Testament. Some are born eunuchs, some are made eunuchs by men, and some become eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Now this little couple of letters here is a Greek prefix meaning the best or noble. And the nuch is a form of the word noah, and naus means intelligence. So the word eunuch means the most intelligent way to be. Now this statement of Christ, some are born eunuchs, some are made eunuchs by men, some become eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake, led to one of the greatest errors of the early Christian period. It led to certain men who thought they were going to secure power if they gained this eunuch form, to sacrificing their genital organs by cutting them off. They thought, if it's true, the kingdom of heaven consists in power, and you will see the kingdom of heaven coming in power. And mysteriously, their great teacher had said, some are born eunuchs, that means with the best way of living. Some are made so by men, and some become so for the kingdom of heaven's sake. That means in order to secure power, if you cut off your sexuality, you will get it. Now the men that did do this, called the sacrificium phalli, or cutting off of the male organ, to get this power, had made an equation that the generative power in the human being, as in the animal world, as in the plant world, is somehow mysteriously connected with the force of evolution. So that if you stop the leakage through the sexual nature, you will retain the power that would otherwise be lost, and you will become very powerful, and you will be able to rule people. Now, early church leaders who performed this sacrifice on themselves became very great nuisances to everybody else, because once they'd done it, they assumed they were powerful, and they began pushing people around. And if you read early church history, you will find some lovely examples of the men that did this, and what terrible nuisances they became to everybody, because now the energy they were not expending in the old way of sex had sublimated itself in the body and become a wonderful new talent of criticizing, dogmatizing, and ordering about. The energy not expended physically was now being expended mentally and especially verbally, pushing people about. There had been a misunderstanding of the principle. And what Christ meant by this was something slightly different, like the opposite of it. What he meant to say was, some people are born in a state of balance, such that they are conscious of their physicality, the gamma function, conscious that they are conscious, that's the lambda function. A few people are aware that they are physical, and they are also intelligent, conscious beings of initiative. Now, some other people are not born in that way, there's very few like that, but they are made so by what? By education. That is to say, you can take a fellow who wasn't born with this insight, I'm a physical body, gamma, but I'm also an intelligence, lambda. With my physical body, I can receive sense stimuli from objects around me, but with my intelligence, I can categorize and use those stimuli to change my environment. We get hold of some people who are interested to be educated, and we can start. Some are made eunuchs by men. That is to say, some are educated to know they are physical bodies, they are also intelligences. They are great thinkers, but they have sensitive feelings too. So they have physicality, a female principle, sensitivity, a female principle, intellectuality, a male principle, and initiative, a male principle, all in the same being. And you can be educated to do this. You can teach a child But it is a physical body. You can get hold of it and say, look, this is a physical body. I'm holding it. Try and get out of my grip. The child tries to get out, and you don't let him out. You see, you cannot get out of my grip, but you can try. I want you to try harder. And then when the child tries harder, you loosen your grip a bit, and apparently the little boy escapes, and he smiles. He's now got positivity. He can get out of your grip. And you encourage the child by putting it in difficult situations and then releasing it subtly so that it actually thinks it has won. In this way, you educate it into self-confidence. It actually begins to see that it can initiate itself. And then you take little puzzles and you show him how to put bricks together and how to get pieces of bent nails and put them together and take them apart in Chinese puzzlery. And you say, this is the development of your intellect. There is a way of doing this thing. This is called making eunuchs by men. That is in a true educational process. But then there is a third way. Some become eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Now, the kingdom of heaven consists in power. It consists in a field of energy that is so subtle that your physical eyes can't see it, but it's really there. We'll have a little silence for this bit. Listen to the silence a minute. Can you hear that the noise of the machine was being adjusted to beforehand, but now you can hear something else? You can hear what you call silence. It has a characteristic, doesn't it? It's not nothing. If you listen, can you hear funny noises? Can you hear the noise of that lamp? Can you hear something running somewhere? Like somebody may have left a tap on it. If you listen very carefully, you begin to hear the sound of somebody moving a sleeve, which you would not have noticed before, would you? And then think, your sensitivity can be extended to infinity. The only reason it has not been kept so is because of concentration upon the particular material objective that has been chosen and imposed in a materially biased educational system. So we can extend our sensitivity beyond anything that ordinary sense perception knows about. When people do this deliberately, they're called sensitives. Some so-called spiritualist mediums approximate to this. Yoga practice is supposed to help you to develop it. Meditation can help you to develop it. And when you understand that increase of sensitivity is increase of sense data, the more quiet you can make yourself, the more you can hear. The more you can hear, the more information you get. So that increase of sensitivity is a movement towards power. It's a movement towards knowing more and being able to do more. Because when you know more and you adjust to what you know, you can accomplish more. And then you discover in your sensitivity you find a peculiar thing about the sense of hearing. It convinces you that you are a being of initiative. Just do this little experiment. Listen to the sound of the air. Can you feel inside you a kind of tension? We call it psychologically attention. Pay attention to the air. See if you can hear sounds. Is it absolutely silent? No. Now, while you're listening, I want you to focus on something, like, say, that lamp or that one. See if the quality of the content of consciousness changes. Does it remain the same? Is it exactly the same? Try this little modification. Listen very carefully and then focus on the person next to you. Close your eyes and listen to the person next to you. See if you can hear them breathing. See if you can feel the rhythm in their body as the lungs contract and expand. Have you got no information or some information? Some information? Is there anybody with no information about the person next to them? You? Sure. And you always have no information about the person next to you, don't you? Because you are my best example, aren't you? You are focused, self-confessed on you, right? So you don't really want to know what's going on in anybody else, do you? Let's try it. Is it not true generally of you that you don't want to know anything about anybody unless it adds to your power? Particularize physical problem and focus on your body as the means to solve it, you logically cut yourself off from the extension of sensitivity. Right? If you feel and listen, you will get more information than you have. And in the process of this, you will discover your initiative, because to feel in this way, you have to focus. And you have to remember that you are focusing. And you have to tell yourself, I am focusing on this being, on that being, on the other being. And you discover that you have this power to converge upon a content of consciousness. Let's do an example with my friend Gerhard again, who will oblige by telling me, are you aware of that spotlight up there, Gerhard, without turning your eyes? With your eyes open, are you aware that it's there without turning your head? Not really. Are you aware of that one without turning your head? You are. Your head is slightly canted towards that side, isn't it? Now put it halfway between these two lights. I want you to shift your attention to the periphery of the eye. In other words, instead of focusing sharply on an object somewhere here, I want you to put your eyes out to focus and shift the attention to the periphery of the eye, and then tell me whether you're not aware there's a light over there and a light over there without turning your eyes. But you're aware of these two. But normally, in your usual process, you wouldn't bother to make such an observation, would you? Now, while you're peripherally aware of those two, I want you to do this little experiment. I want you to shift your attention, but not your eyes. Don't move your eyes. Shift your attention to that light. And notice what happens inside you. Then shift your attention to that light, and notice what happens inside you. Can you feel that you can do this shift?
Slight change.
There's a slight change. Now, can you feel what you're doing inside your head to do it?
It's a shift of attention. Isn't it?
Shift of attention. Now, this shift of attention is today measurable. It's a shift of a biomagnetic field in the brain, and this can be measured in microvolts, just like a muscle tension could be measured in millivolts. There's a very small amount of current, but there's a definite tension there. When we pay attention to anything, we actually tense the biomagnetic field. That means the field of our life. Our life is an energy. That energy is able to tense itself. And that tension, that power of focus, we call masculine. The power of formal convergence, formal focus, we call masculine. To bring consciousness to a point is masculine. To leave it spread out is feminine. Let us say, if I don't focus now, I'm not focusing my eyes, but I'm aware of all the people in the room. And that is a feminine act, because I'm not focused. So I'm using the feminine side of my being. I'm aware of all the people here, and I'm not focused. That is feminine. Now I will deliberately look at my friend Josie there. I will converge upon her. In doing so, I have put the others over here very much out of my awareness, and those, Josie is my centre of concentration. That concentration, that convergence is masculine. It is exactly the same function that created the sperm out of a one-time egg, convergence. I'm aware of the lady in front of her, but not so intensely as of Josie. I'm aware of Georgie behind Josie, but not so intensely as I'm aware of Josie. Now Socrates said, and the Greeks generally believed, that when you look at somebody, an energy goes out of the eye. And modern optical theory said, piffle, rubbish, light comes in at the eye, but nothing goes out. But very careful measurements show that there is a real polarity in the human eye, electrical. You can put electrodes on your eyeballs, you can turn your eye sideways and put an electrode there, say outside of the eye, and therefore you can measure towards the back of the eye there and towards the front of the eye there, and you actually find a field difference between the front and the back of the eye, in which the front of the eye is positive and the back of the eye is negative. That means to say, there is really a tension in the field. The field is energy spread out, and this energy is able to converge, to focus itself. And when it focuses, it is masculine. And when it spreads itself, it is feminine. Now it's obvious that when you spread yourself consciously, you get generalized information. In fact, when you're driving your car normally, you are driving like a woman. That is to say, you drive with your consciousness spread out. You're aware whether there's a person about to step off the pavement there, whether there's a dog over there. You get them peripherally. And the moment you see a possibility of danger, you convert from the feminine to the masculine. You converge. You're aware there's a dog running along the pavement. If it steps off the pavement, you do a quick flick. You catch it. That quick, convergent flick is masculine. The generalized awareness is feminine. There's two kinds of awareness there. Convergent, masculine. Spread, feminine. But to make the change, you have to use your initiative. And the initiative is masculine, whereas the passive acceptance of the situation is feminine. So supposing you were driving down the road and you had your feminine mode operating, spread, you're aware a dog is going down the pavement. You're also aware that it stepped off the pavement, but you didn't bother to converge upon it to see how far it's gone. So you hit the dog and kill it. That was a feminine act, because you didn't converge. Now, if on the other hand, you were looking too wildly for stray dogs like this, and birds in the air, and butterflies on the windscreen, you'd be so convergent and so multiplicity impelled by myriads of stimuli, you would lose your feminine general awareness and you'd crash into something in a male way. See, two kinds of accidents. Diffuse consciousness accidents and excessively convergent accidents. What you want to do is to have both kinds of accidents deliberately at will, when necessary. Now, the question was, how do girls get in contact with their male half? The answer is by first deciding that they are never ever, of course they'll fail, but first they must make the decision, they're never ever going to wait for a boy to take the initiative again. They're not going to diffuse their consciousness merely, they're going to learn to converge. They're going to learn to look for what they think worth having and go over and get it. They march over to a boy and they look at him and say, haven't you met before somewhere, girl? They're going to do it, you see. When they do this, they're masculine. Now, because of the feminization of the horrorless period, that is today, kind of boy, it's surprising how often they'll get away with it. That is, they'll catch themselves what is called a wife-type husband with that technique. But the way to do it is by convergence. That's one way. Convergence must be gained if you are to get in contact with your masculine half. But not only convergence, initiative. You must initiate changes. If one technique fails, you just change it for another technique. And you never allow yourself to merely diffuse your consciousness and stay in that state, and you never allow yourself to fall into physical inertia. So there is the technique. You cultivate convergence and initiative, subjection to the logic of the situation, and you let these gradually take over the direction of your life instead of the opposites. Spread awareness, waiting for it, and the inertia of physicality. Now the question is it worth doing? And the answer is yes. Are you smiling about Jersey? Is it worth doing? Is it worth doing, Jersey? In some cases it is. You know that old silly joke about when men were men and women were glad of it. Those days have gone. So now it is a question of deciding in which particular case, not whether it is worth it, you know perfectly well it is worth it, but whether this is a particular case in which it is worth it, and to what degree, because of a great law, the law of the inequality of finance. We saw that when the primary egg split, half of it went east, half west, half into the deep water, half into the shallow water, and in the process became differentiated by the stimuli. So it means that every person you meet has a unique balance of male and female principles within. And this is what you were referring to, wasn't it? That when you meet a so-called male, or when a so-called male meets a so-called female, the situation is always unique. There's always a very peculiar balance in which initiative and intellectuality are there in a certain proportion with feeling sensitivity and physical stress. All those four are there simultaneously in every being. But the balance of them changes, and it changes every moment. And this is why we get a doctrine, a yogic doctrine of here nowness. If you are divergent in your awareness and convergent simultaneously, if you have a body presence, you know you exist as a physical being, and yet you have initiative, you can, in immediate here-now terms, evaluate the condition of the person to whom you intend to relate. You can see how much initiative there is there. If there isn't much, give it a little push. You can see how much sensitivity of feeling there is there, and not tread upon its toes too heavily. You can see how much intellectuality there is there, and either climb down while it expresses itself, or join in for the fun of it. In this here now immediate evaluation, you can evaluate the person to whom you intend to relate. Now this was a question about how can a boy be discovered in a girl so that she doesn't have to hang around waiting for a being called boy to act like a male, to balance herself so that she can conduct her own life. The other side of it is, how does a boy get hold of his feelings and his sense of bodiness like a girl has? And this is equally important. for the male, there has to be a deliberate practice, an acceptance that intellection is not the only mode of awareness, that feeling sensitivity gives information that intellectual calculations cannot give, and that initiative itself, a male function, is not the only way of interfering with reality. The way of stillness also interferes. Now, we'll examine this rather carefully. It's perfectly obvious that initiative can interfere, because I can reverse this pen. I can put it on there. I'm interfering with initiative. That's a masculine trick. But there's another called the way of the woman. Lao Tse calls it the way of the woman. Conquering with the way of the woman. When you sit still, what are you doing with your energy? When you do nothing, what are you doing? You are stilling your energy. Now, in order to still energy, what are you doing? Nothing? You have to get hold of it. Now, this getting hold of one's own energy we call reflexive self-consciousness. To get hold of one's own energy, which is associated with this body, is to get hold of encapsulated intelligence. And this self getting hold of does a very peculiar thing to the whole infinite field of energy. We are living on the Earth inside the solar system. The Earth has a certain orbital distance from the Sun that places it within the sphere of the Sun's energy at such a distance that human life is possible. It is not possible for life to evolve on any other orbit. The Earth orbit is the orbit where the heat of the Sun is neither too much nor too little for human life to evolve, and therefore it is here that we are. When we become aware of this, we center ourselves. Centering is the beginning of axiality. You posit that you are inside your being, you feel yourself. Remember, Bruno in the year 1600 was burned at the stake for saying this. You feel yourself to be a center of infinity. Your circumference is nowhere, it's extended infinitely, but your center is where you are. And if you get hold of this power where you are, in your center, and you still it, does the energy round about stay the same? No, what does it do? It becomes interested, you see? If you positively get hold of yourself, you have become a center of interest. Now observe this. Most human beings are not interested in themselves at all. They're not interested in their real self, what it is, where it's from, whether it's eternal, whether it's immortal. They're interested in something outside themselves, which they pursue, and they think by accreting that thing to themselves in a mineral way, they will become stronger. The exact opposite of the truth. When the average human being's interest is outside himself, he comes under that peculiar law, where there is interest in a particular, the universal field is also interested. Where you are interested, the field is interested. So if I look at Zero, like that, with interest, I'm looking at you with interest now, Zero. Pulling out his head, you're a desirable creature. Now I look at David, that's a call my quick look. Pulling out, really mean it, you see. And I start being interested. What I'm doing is causing energy to drift to you. I'm actually making you more powerful than me. Now that's the inversion of what I'm trying to do. So that when a naughty boy gives what in old fashioned terminology, when I was a young man, they used to call the glad eye. I've never heard that expression for 50 years. The glad eye. Meaning, glad I have seen you. A little later they used to call it the I am bowled over, come and bowl me over, look. the other thing, a sudden flash of interest, and that creates, I focus on you, you are interesting. The field, the whole field of the universe begins to converge on you. You begin to become more powerful. The more I do it, the more I think you're worth having. And I'm doing it. I'm making you more worth having than I'm making me. Now, that's the way most people do it. They continue to look outwards and compare values on other people, don't they? Everybody's grass seems greener. Yeah? Now, the true way of doing it, which is very difficult, is being still on the inside. Feminizing, instead of converging on an external object, which is a masculine thing, spread consciousness, sit still and wait. That's called conquering with the way of a woman. Now, women know this is a technique, don't they? Because they know that most males are, to a certain degree, convergent. And as soon as they see a relatively quiet girl, they feel they want to interfere with it. Why? Because if it's quiet, if it's not dictating, it means that the male can feel relatively superior. There's one that's not bashing people about. Maybe she's a quiet girl. Yeah, I'll go and interfere with her. Stillness provokes interference. Yeah? You agree? Are you finding it hard to say yes?
What?
Because it does. Have you ever seen the still look in a female animal? That provokes the male. Even in deer and things like that. This female trick runs through the whole of creation. Women intuitively know that if they keep still when there's a bit of excess energy around in the male conversion, and they look peaceful and quiet, his interference intent will grow. And like the black widow spider, that sudden only comes at the end, not at the beginning.